The following podcast is a Carolina Boys production. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. We hope 2023 was great to everybody. You guys have certainly been great to us, tuning in each and every week. This will close out 2023. I got a little drunk last night, I'll admit, so I didn't know where I put the audio, and it's not coming out till 2024, but technically this closed out the year. Behind the serial killer episode and then that bone-chilling phone conversation you heard, that was the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo, making a phone call, a return phone call, if you will, to one of his earlier victims. So now that you have the context, just think of how chilling it was for that young lady to get that phone call and to hear that sinister voice on the other end. I got to tell you, I didn't know a ton about the Golden State Killer until I started looking in preparation for this episode. And my God, this man was a brutal guy. So I think you guys are going to enjoy it as we deep dive here into the Golden State Killer, Joseph DeAngelo, on Behind the Serial Killer. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Crime and Entertainment. I have here a familiar face again, Ignacio Esteban. Ignacio, how are you, my friend?
No, Hollywood Wade, man. Doing good, man. Doing good. Love doing these shows, man. Behind the Serial Killer. I think people are getting really interested in these segments.
Yeah, we got Behind the Gangsters, we got Behind the Serial Killers. I mean, it falls right into what we do here, crime and entertainment.
Yes.
And, you know, these guys, I think what the fascination is, and it's obvious when you look at, you know, Peacock, Hulu, Amazon, Netflix, they have these documentaries and they all do very well. I think what it is, it's not that, you know, they're being glorified, because obviously what they did is horrible. But it's just trying to figure out what makes these people tick, what makes people do these things. I mean, so far, you know, we've covered Gacy. That was our last episode. We covered Richard Ramirez, Albert Fish. I mean, what makes some of these people do some of the things that they did? And today we've got an interesting one, man. And I'll be honest, until I started researching, I didn't know a ton about this guy. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr., otherwise known as the Golden State Killer. He's got a couple other names that he had throughout his time, but wow.
He was the original Night Stalker.
Yes.
Yep. He was the original Night Stalker. He had a lot of monikers. No doubt about it. He had a lot of monikers. And people confused him. Well, one thing, that's why Ramirez ended up being the Night Stalker. I think they thought they were one the same until the DNA and everything came out, but their MO was kind of similar, right?
Very similar. And that was the thing is like, it kind of progressed from, you know, just rapes, and then it was began the murder. So, you know, not exactly keeping your pattern, but, you know, you don't think a rapist is just going to turn into a murderer mid spree. You know, I mean, at least typically they don't. But I mean,
burglar, first shoplifter.
Yep.
Then burglar, then rapist, and then serial killer. I mean, the numbers are, I think they said over 100 burglaries, over 50 rapes, and 13 murders that they can prove.
Yeah.
That he pled guilty to. Unbelievable.
Crazy story, man. We're going to get into it here today a little bit. We're going to start off with a little bit of an overview of who he is and, you know, what he got into. We're going to detail some of the crimes. Some of these things are very, very wicked that he did. And then also some of the phone calls. I got a phone call.
Yes.
And I'm going to stick in here. And then just, I got some of the, I guess, transcripts, you would say, not the actual phone calls, of what he said to some of the victims that he called him. And it's just bone chilling stuff that he would reach out to these people
after he raped them,
after the fact, after he had raped them. Messages that are just, I mean, just bone chilling, dude. I'm telling you.
Yeah, it's a psychopath, no doubt about that.
So Joseph James DeAngelo Jr., born November 8, 1945, is an American serial killer, rapist, burglar, also former police officer. Imagine that. And former mechanic who committed, like you said, at least 13 murders, 51 rapes, 120 burglaries.
Yes.
California between 1974 and 1986. He was responsible for three known separate crime sprees throughout the state. That's why he had so many different names, is once the heat got on in one area, it wasn't, you know, beyond him to just go ahead and bounce to another area. The San Joaquin Valley, DeAngelo was known as the Visalia Ransacker before moving over to the Sacramento area, where he was known as the East Area Rapist. He also had attacks in Stockton, Modesto, Costa County. He committed serial murders in Santa Barbara, Ventura, Orange County. I mean, just all over. And that's where he was actually known as the Night Stalker, and later as the original Night Stalker, because he was before, you know, Ramirez. And obviously we covered him, I think, two episodes ago. So if you hadn't checked that out, run back and check that out. Excellent.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a great one.
Yeah, that was a wicked guy. I think I told the story on there, but my wife watched the Netflix documentary, which, by the way, I've reached out to, I think his name is it Gil, the detective on there?
Yeah.
He's having surgery, but after he's he's done with his surgery and healed up, he's actually going to come on the show.
Nice.
Be pretty interesting. Yeah, yes, get him on there and pick his brain a little bit.
That'd be great.
So a little bit of early life. I mean, what do you know about his early life here? What do you got on the book?
Yeah. Yeah. When I researched psycho killers and I look into DeAngelo, I mean, I'd done Ramirez. And I said, well, I got to marry up. These guys were same time period, same names and everything else right there. They both had something very similar that I'd picked up. They both came from abusive households.
Mm-hmm.
Both fathers were extremely abusive. I mean, remember Ramirez was chained outside to the cemetery and beaten and left overnight, traumatized him. And of course, he had the family issues with his cousin being a Green Beret in Vietnam. He himself was a serial killer. He came from a family serial killer. His father allegedly, what has been documented, was extremely abusive with him and his siblings. Extremely mm-hmm. abusive. And then on top of that, he had more drama, more because he was a military brat. His father was, after Second World War, he was a sergeant in the army. They traveled a lot all over Europe, right? And allegedly, he witnessed his seven-year-old sister get raped near one of these facilities, and he told his father about it, and he beat him down submission to be quiet about it.
Yeah.
All the things dramatized him. And then he took it out on the animals, very similar to Dahmer. Right? Remember how Dahmer used to kill animals? He would also kill a lot of the animals locally and play with their bones. And Dahmer used to call them his fiddlesticks. So I found some interesting traits in each one of them that eventually trigger him. And then he would say later, and we'll talk about that, it wasn't him that did it. It was Jerry that forced him to do it. Mm-hmm. And then we'll talk about some theories. Why did he stop in the mid-80s and 2018? So,
well, I wanted to touch on, you know, him saying that he witnessed the two airmen, you know, do sexual acts on his sister, and then it got buried. You wonder if at such a young age, did it start to click? And I'm not, you know, giving this guy an excuse or a pass on what he did. Please don't take that. But I do think that things happen in the childhoods of these guys that kind of shape their thinking, regardless of how twisted and screwed up it may be. Do you think that, you know, seeing this act happen maybe put in his mind that these kind of things aren't, you know, maybe wrong, like that he mentioned it to his father, he got beat for it and nothing happened, that maybe in some sick, twisted way, these were okay. It was an okay thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, guys are raping young girls. Maybe he's okay to rape it, and he does things, and there's no consequences to it. And he develops an alter ego. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm the former police officer. I don't do that. But Jerry, he's a bad boy, and he does some bad things. So,
and then didn't he went into the Navy? Is that right?
He was a Navy guy for a few years. He was a mechanic in the Navy. He was there a few years, and then he came to this Northern California area, Sacramento. And he was married, and he went into law enforcement academy. He graduated there and then worked for two police departments up there, Exeter Police Department, Auburn Police Department, where he was eventually fired.
and had a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. Later took postgraduate courses to further his police training.
Yes.
Completed a 32-week police internship at the police department in Roseville. So nothing at this point like too out of whack, except for what you were mentioning. From 1973, May of 73 to August of 76, he was a burglar unit police officer in Exeter, having relocated from Citrus Heights. He then served in Auburn from August 76 to July of 79, when he was arrested for shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. Now, we're talking about a guy that got away with rapes and murders for decades. And I guess his first taste at this, you know, life of crime, he couldn't even steal a hammer and dog repellent. He was sentenced to 6 months of probation and fired that October. But during the process of being fired, he threatened to kill the chief of police and allegedly stalked the chief's house. I don't know about where you stay at, Ignacio, or back in the day on the force, but I got to think, if you're threatening the chief, you're maybe looked at, your file is maybe even put in a drawer of, hey, if shit starts going down, maybe look at this guy. You got to think, and we obviously hadn't got into what he's done thus far, but you got to think maybe there was a ball drop with this guy that they probably should have paid a little bit more attention to him, and you're stalking the chief of police.
Yeah, yeah. And he was seen, allegedly, according to reports, in the area after he was fired near his house, too. So there's a lot of factors there. I think the chief, they said, the victims at least said, the ball was dropped there, that maybe they should have been looking at him a little bit harder, what was going on. I mean, hindsight is obviously 20/20, but yeah, the ball was definitely dropped, I think, on that end.
Yeah, still, you would think somebody doing that to the chief of police is going to have a little bit of, you would like to think more eyes on him, but hey, it was the 70s, you know, early 70s.
Different time,
you know, different circumstances. The first name that he would go by, and I think I'm saying this right, the Visalia Ransacker, Visalia. Mm-hmm. 1974 through 1976, roughly. It was long suspected that the training grounds of the criminal who became the East Area Rapist was the Visalia Ransacker. Although earlier, the crimes dating back as early as 73 and other sprees around the Cordovia Cat Burglar, which was also one of the names they threw out, then the Exeter Ransacker. So again, a lot of names here early, as well as the Visalia burglars that took place after the McGowan shooting that we'll get into here in a little bit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, over a period of 20 months, D'Angelo is believed to have been responsible for one murder and 120 burglaries. That is a lot of burglaries.
That's unbelievable. And he's a burglary detective. Did you know that, too?
Yeah.
That's what he was so good about it.
Yeah, so he knows everything, to kind of like Dexter. You know, Dexter was a serial killer freelance, or he was a blood splatter analysis freelancing as a serial killer. So he knew what to, you know, the things that police look for. So maybe that's one reason what helped him stay under the radar.
That's Ted Bundy, right? He was working, right, for a missing women's unit, right? And then for the state. So he knew exactly the different cases and what leads they had. And definitely like a Bundy, no doubt. And that was during the same time period, you know, with Bundy and these guys, too. You get some really prolific serial killers in the 60s and 70s, and we've talked some of them. Unbelievable. It's hard for them now because technology is so much better. But back then, everything was so spread out. And they didn't have the DNA evidence and everything else they had. They got away with it a lot longer.
Mm-hmm. One of the first recorded ransacking burglaries occurred on March 19, 1974, when a sum of $50 in coins was stolen from a piggy bank. Most of the ransackers' activities involved breaking into houses, rifling through, vandalizing owners' possessions, scattering women's undergarments around the house, stealing a range of low-value items, often ignoring high-value items. He would steal things that was basically meaningless, like driver's licenses or maybe pictures or little trinkets. Really weird, you know, obsession with just the oddball stuff. He would often arrange or display items in the house, rearrange stuff sometimes. He emptied the piggy bank, coin jars, stolen items, often included blue chip stamps, foreign or historic coins, personal items such as, you know, one single earring, cufflinks, rings, medallions. You know, multiple same day ransackings he was doing here, including 12 separate incidences on November the 30th of 1974. That is an addiction or a sickness, like 12. Jesus Christ, man.
Yeah, he's a sick guy. There's no doubt about that. And what he does to the people when he starts escalating, we'll talk about it. It's unbelievable. Maybe not as sick as Ramirez, but it's still up there.
It's close. Yeah. And then some of the things that he's doing here, you know, he's climbing fences, moving through established routes such as parks, walkways, ditches, trails. He's prying open doors, you know, different points of entry, particularly windows. He was a window guy. We got a really creepy story about people waking up, seeing him at a window.
Yeah.
He would leave multiple points of escape, you know, as well throughout the house, garage, other doors, removing window screens, you know, getting into bedrooms, placing warning items such as dishes and bottles against the doors and door handles to realize somebody was coming in. I mean, really, really, I hate to glorify these guys by saying smart, but he was definitely keen on some of the things that he did. He did wear gloves to, you know, be sure to not leave fingerprints.
Yeah.
And one of the early shootings, they didn't really relate to the rapes that were going on, happened in 1975. He broke into a house by the man named Claude Snelling. Did you read about that case?
Yeah. That's the one the daughter's getting raped or about to get raped. And he comes in.
Yeah. It's in the garage.
Yeah.
So, 532 Whitney Lane. Snelling was a journalism professor at a college the Sequoias. He had previously chased a prowler that he discovered under his daughter's window around 10 PM on February the 5th in 1975. So that's another thing we'll look into. He would oftentimes case out houses, hang around houses, maybe even break in and leave stuff before he would come back to actually do, whatever he wanted to do.
That's creepy and scary.
Because by then, you know, he already knows the lay of your land, the lay of your house, probably your work schedule. So
he liked middle-class families, single-story middle-class families. That's it. He didn't want too high-end because, you know, there's could be issues there with security. It's not like today when more people have security. Back then, people even, especially in Northern California, how nice the weather is, they kept the windows open, right? Yep. It's easy to break in like that. Now, today, people, I think a lot of people, and some people don't, but I always recommend people lock down at night because you don't know who's watching.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
On September the 11th, he was awakened around 2 a.m. by a strange noise. Upon leaving his bedroom, Snelling ran through the open back door and confronted a ski mask intruder in his carport attempting to kidnap his daughter, who had been subdued with threats of being stabbed or shot. Snelling was then shot twice, staggered back into the house to his wife, and later died after the shooting. The assailant fled the scene, leaving behind a stolen bicycle at 615 Redwood Street. After the murder, Bess Snelling, 16, underwent hypnosis in order to gather information and further details. I've always thought that's an interesting practice to put people under hypnosis to see if they can, recall stuff. Visalia police committed more resources to apprehending the ransacker, and a $4,000 reward was posted. Nighttime stakeouts were set near the house that had previously prowled, and the ransacking still continued. At around 8:30 p.m. on December the 12th, 1975, a masked man entered the backyard of a house on Kiowa Avenue near where the ransacker had been reported to frequent. When Detective William McGowan on a stakeout attempted to detain the man, the suspect shrieked, removed his mask, and then pretended to surrender. After McGowan fired a warning shot, however, he jumped the fence and took off and escaped. So again, really close to getting caught.
That's close. That's
there in 1975.
Close. Yeah.
He actually shot at McGowan and shattered his flashlight. And again, he was able to escape. So already in early, he's having some close calls here. So that might be why he backed off of the killing and maybe just stuck to the rape. Because, you know, when you start killing people, rape is horrible.
It's horrible. When
you start killing people, that's going to garner, a little bit more peace presence. You're going to be looked at and people are going to, they're going to be ready. They're going to start arming themselves.
Yeah. And he gets more and more, like we'll talk about more brazen. He even sometimes when he has them tied up after he rapes the females, he then starts cooking dinner.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're going to get into that here. So he becomes known now as the East Area Rapist. He moved to the Sacramento area in 1976. His crimes escalated from burglary, as we said, to rape. He initially centered on the unincorporated areas of Carmichael and Citrus Heights, Rancho Cordova, east of Sacramento. His initial modus operandi, like you said, was middle-class houses.
Yeah.
Maybe where the women lived alone.
Single story too.
Houses. Yep. Yeah. No dogs, at least in the beginning. He was seen a number of times, but always successfully fled. On one occasion, like I said, shot at, but not hit, obviously. Most victims had seen or heard a prowler on their property before the attacks. Again, like we said, he's already scouring these things out.
Right.
Police believe the offender would conduct extensive reconnaissance in a targeted neighborhood, looking into the prowling of the yards. So I think that's some of his, maybe his cop intuition coming back. You know, he's wanting to make sure stuff's in line.
And he's a detective. He knows what he's looking for. He knows what he's doing. He's an insider there, and he knows how not to leave evidence either. Mm-hmm. So he's smart about it. That's why he was never caught until they got creative.
Yep. And he would often tie these women up with different things, either shoelaces, cords from the house, you know, many different things. He used whatever was in his grasp. You know, kind of like BTK would do. You know, mm-hmm. he would sometimes bring in rope.
Ramirez. Ramirez did also.
Same thing Ramirez did.
Diamond knot killer too, right? He was called because it was diamond knots he would leave.
Yep. Yeah. So a lot of different things that he would do. As you said, he would sometimes spend hours in the home, ransacking closets, drawers, eating food in the kitchen, drinking beer,
yes.
raping the women, not once, but twice. And in some cases, three times.
Yes, you know,
he would eat
all night there. Sometimes spent all night.
Yeah.
It's insane.
The balls on this guy to spend all night.
Yeah. There's one story there. I think I sent it to you when the show was on 60 Minutes there, where he rapes a teenage girl.
Mm-hmm.
And she's 13, but he ties up the mom. And this becomes his MO. He puts the dishes on their back when he ties them up. And if the dishes start moving or rattling, he says, I'm going to come and kill you, and you. So that better be steady. I'm going to finish doing my business, and then they're all right. But then later that will change, and he would kill them regardless.
Yeah.
Even if they were obedient at the end when he got really crazy, then he just kills everybody.
One of the first victims was awakened by a tapping sound. She noticed the silhouette of a man standing in her doorway, and he was tapping something against the door. It turned out to be a knife. As she switched on the light switch, she seen a man standing there tapping the knife against the doorframe, wearing a mask, dark gloves, and a t-shirt, but was naked from the waist down, also visibly aroused.
Oh, boy.
She pulls the sheets over her face and rolls over. He then jumped onto her, ripped the sheets off, placed the knife to the tip of her temple, hard enough to where it drew blood, and he always spoke like clenching his teeth, like, I mean, he never wanted to, I think, use his regular voice. He wanted to kind of disguise it, but always clenched teeth and kind of like a low growl.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he would speak to her. And in an angry whisper, he told her that he, you know, the things that he was going to do to her.
Yeah.
Can you imagine waking up and looking at the silhouette of your door and seeing a man standing there, A, with a mask on, that's scary enough, B, tapping a knife in the doorway, and this asshole ain't got no pants on.
No, that's when you're reaching for your 45 pretty quick.
Exactly. Now, and this is something, like I said, that would happen in most of the cases where he would whisper like that. And through clenched teeth, he says to her, you know, I'll stick this knife in you if you move. I want to fuck you. And that's what he says to her. Now, he commands her to take his nightgown off. He then told her to roll over. He tied her wrist with a pre-cut rope that he brought in with him. Hmm. He went through the room and came back, tied her wrist again with one of her own cloth belts. So maybe he didn't think it were tied up good enough of what he had. Told her to roll over. He raped her. She opened her eyes only when he was finished to see him wipe himself off with a bed sheet, drop it to the floor. Then standing there, he asked about money. Now, he would ask about money in a lot of these robberies, even though I don't think money was the reason why he was there, obviously. No,
he got off on that stuff.
Because before she could even answer, he told her to shut up and turn around.
Oh, boy.
He left the room again. He took a hairdryer, tied up her ankles, doubled it by tying a bra around her ankles. Once again, wandered through the room until he found her nightgown, tied it up as a gag, and put it in her mouth. I can't even begin to imagine like what that would... I don't like anything in my mouth like that. Like I would probably just throw up.
And that poor woman, what is she thinking is going to happen to her now?
Yeah. I mean, her mind has got to be all over the place.
Yeah.
She continued to hear him go through the room. When he returned, he said, quote, don't move while I'm here. I'll kill you. He left the bedroom, started going through the drawers in the kitchen. She heard him talking, like talking to himself. She, for a period of time, I think she even thought there might have been two people there. And this was something that maybe we'll get into with that, you know, whoever Very. He thinks he's talking to at the end.
Yeah.
Cause he's like almost whispering to himself. So it kind of threw her, for a loop. And when she asked, I think she said, "Are you still there?" or something like that. And he come back in and he said, quote, "I told you to shut up."
Well,
now he did wind up leaving. The description of the man weighed about 160 pounds, may have had dark hair, obviously hard to tell. Maybe she got a look at the eyebrows, possibly. You know, the hair on his legs was dark. She said, little muscular, you know, not too much big, but this is a key thing. And I've got to bring this up.
Oh yeah.
He was a very small man, I guess we'll say. He was not very well endowed. His tools were not from the big boy section of Home Depot. We'll put it like that.
We'll leave it like that, yeah.
Noticeably so. And this was on the case with a few of these cases, but that's one thing that this woman noticed that, you know, stuck out, I guess, or did not stick out.
Oh yeah. Well,
yeah. That's significant, huh? Did not stick out, so to speak.
Interesting.
She did say that, and this could be a reason, a deep-seated reason, why maybe he had to do some of the things that he did. I don't want to get too far in the psychological rabbit hole, but it could.
But it is interesting. It is a thing to have between the abuse and his lack of, let's say, having a good tool.
Yeah.
And other things that could all play into it, for sure. For sure.
She said that he did wear gloves, which he never took off. Said that he was, you know, approximately 20 to 25 years old at this time, spoke through clenched teeth, barely moving his lips under the mask. Altogether, he was probably in house around 20 minutes. For the most part, quick. Investigators discovered the house had been ransacked, papers and other, you know, stuff strewn all over the house. Purse was on the back patio, contents was scattered. So there's really no, I guess, other than the rape, I think maybe he's just maybe trying to make it difficult for police, trying to figure out maybe what caused this. Like, you know, maybe like he's looking for something, like maybe it could be drug related, like somebody coming in looking for something. But I think maybe, in my opinion, he's just trying to make it more convoluted.
Yeah. What twisted guy. He does that. And then he goes back to work and tries to enforce the laws. Right. Well, he breaks the laws.
Yeah.
What a guy.
Now, he did attempt to try to cut the phone line. They seen marks where it was tried to cut, but it was actually unsuccessful. He wasn't able to break it underneath them. Now, this is something that I found kind of odd. Like, how do you not know how to cut a phone line? I don't really know. Because back then, phone lines are prevalent because that's how people communicated. It's not like today where everybody's got a cell phone in their hand.
Yeah.
So you cut a phone line, you're rendering a house, you know, pretty much helpless to try to get help.
Yeah.
You know, there's different theories of why he maybe couldn't get that done, but they obviously see that he was able to pry into the back door. They found wood chips around the bottom of the patio, which led him to know that was his point of entry. Before approaching the bedroom, they said that he would, you know, a lot of times look in through the windows, like you said, and if people didn't have blinds, he could actually see what was going on. They said they actually found a bottle of Johnson's baby oil that he had used before he come in there to obviously submit that poor woman to, you know, the unspeakable that he did.
Yeah.
So jumping right into his first rape, like he's pretty brutal just already. And he's going to get a lot more brutal, but what do you think? Do you think getting away with this first one maybe set a fire?
Oh, I think so. I don't know. Maybe it's the first one he got caught. Maybe he had done something else on the work and on duty. I mean, maybe he had done it before, right? I mean, how does someone go from, but he had issues. You could tell he had issues and things were developing, getting bigger and stronger because, you know, that's not normal behavior.
No.
Especially someone who's in law enforcement. Prior Navy, guy was in the Navy. He's been in the academies. He's worked already, but it appears what I was hearing too, he's having problems at work too, though.
Yeah.
He's being reprimanded at work for issues he's having. So things are getting a little bit out of control. He ends up leaving that one police department to go Auburn. And then obviously we'll get into that, what happens with the chief and how he gets fired and all that. But I think for sure he enjoys the sexual charge of the power he has to scare and petrify these women. And I think he gets a big charge out of that.
Now, the thing is, too, he didn't necessarily always look for older women, like even as young as 15, 16, 13. He would go and do them. Victim number two here, and I'm trying to stay away from names if at all possible, especially ones that were younger.
Sure.
Victim number two, 15, was her age. She was home alone with her sister, who was 16. So they were watching television until about 10 p.m. that night. They went to bed, and before going to bed, victim number two checked all the locks on the doors. This was around 2 a.m. She was woken up by a hand over her mouth.
Oh, wow.
And with this clenched teeth voice, angrily whispering, quote, "Shut up, I have a knife. And if you don't shut up, I can kill you." Now, she was half awake, you know, with this going on. She's really kind of catching her off guard. He rolled her off the bed onto the floor. She bumped the man's leg in the process, managed to get out of the room yelling for her sister. The man caught her, hit her in the back of the head 3 or 4 times. Now, she fell on the floor. She was still yelling for her sister, and he hit her a couple of more times. Now, smart on this girl's part, she decided to fake like she was unconscious. He told her to shut up, and he had already tied her sister up. Now, she didn't respond to him. She continued to act like she was knocked out and that she was unconscious, but the man didn't believe her, and he got really angry, saying, quote, "Get your hands behind your back." Just the fact that the 15-year-old girl is having to go through all this. I mean, she's got to be panicking. I mean, it's just horrible that she's going through all this, and her sister. And again, he knew that they were alone. Like, so again, he's stalking these houses.
He's stalking the Night Stalker. And that's why he's the original Night Stalker. He knew what he was doing. He was getting good at it. Inside information there. And, but you know, what a sick guy to pick on such, and you know, this will traumatize these teenagers for the rest of their lives.
Oh yeah.
Massive psychological damage.
And he tied their hands behind their back very tightly. He leaned in close to her ear through his clenched teeth and said, "You do everything I want and I will fill my bag and then leave." He shoved a sock into her mouth, tied a towel around her head, you know, and gagged her, tied her feet tightly, drug her into the bedroom, threw her on the bed, stomach down, and said, quote, "If you move or make this bed twinge, I'll kill you." You know, like I said earlier, you put something like that in my mouth, we're going to have some problems. Like, I can't even begin to process that psychologically, what she had to be going through. The man left the bedroom, went into the kitchen, the other bedroom. She could hear him going through everything. He was slamming drawers, going through closets. He came back, checked on her, then left, continued going through other things, came back, tied a towel around her head so she could not see the victim. Estimated that 15 minutes after he came back and turned on the light, he untied her feet, pulled down her underwear, and then raped her, you know, at least twice.
Oh, wow.
He'd done this while her ankles were tied. He again asked where the money was. Again, he always asked for money, even though I really don't think that's why he was there. She nodded towards the dresser, which she had $6 saved.
Oh, poor thing.
And he took the $6. I mean, what a piece of shit.
That's a piece of work. Yeah.
The drawers dumped the content. He dumped out the contents of the drawer, threw it down, and went out and went to the sister's room. He looked in more drawers, returned, stood over the victim, and said, quote, "I knew when I saw you at junior prom, I had to fuck you."
Wow.
So that's throwing a little bit of a loop in this. And the thing is, she didn't really buy it because she had had a picture of herself at her junior prom on her dresser with her boyfriend's name on the back. So she assumed that maybe he seen that picture and was just kind of running off at the mouth.
Just to freak her out more.
Yeah. Just to freak her out a little bit more. And that's just more psychology and mind games that he's playing. And that's a theme throughout all these, that it doesn't seem like it's about the rape specifically. It's just about putting as much fear into these women as possible. You know, stressing them out emotionally, beating them up physically. It's destroying them, man. Like you said, they're never going to be the same physically, mentally, ever again.
Will anybody be the same again if they get treated like that? Right. When some freak, can you ever sleep normally again?
No, I could never sleep normally again. I would need all types of, guns, alarm systems. Like, it would just be
medication.
A lot of things.
You heard the wind blowing a certain way. You're thinking, what's going on here, right? You can never be the same again. You never feel comfortable in your own home. Your home is supposed to be your sanctuary, right? Where you feel the safest place in the world. And then one night you get this Night Stalker comes in your door, like you said, with a knife in his hand, half naked. What the fuck?
and he actually went back in the notes here. He went back and raped her a third time before he left. So not just once, not twice, but three times.
What a sick guy.
You know, again, not taking anything of big value. Not like he's, you know, coming away with a big haul. He's just really, he's there to inflict the pain.
Mm-hmm. Emotionally and physically. Yeah.
There was no sounds in the house. So she got the towel off her head, noticed that it was now like 4:30 a.m. So, you know, there's 2 hours that she went through all this. Cause I think the last time she said she seen it was a little around two when all this stuff started. So two and a half hours that she's doing this. She made it to her sister's room, loosened the knots that was on her hands. She got free and was able to call the police from the master bedroom. The investigation revealed footprints outside the victim's window, which indicated that he had watched her from outside for a while for this to happen. Again, he's just standing right outside. He had to go through the victim's bedroom in order to get to the hallway. Thus, it seemed that he intended exactly what to do going past the one sister, getting to the other one, maybe because the older one, you know, maybe she could put up more of a fight. Was it older?
Yeah. This one's weaker and inexperienced. This one might do more damage. So, yeah, you never know with these people how they think. If we're thinking normally, you wouldn't be there, but he's not.
Yeah. And I mean, again, you know, I want to emphasize you're doing this to 15, 16-year-old girls, man. It's just, it's awful. Awful. Awful.
And he'll do it to a 13-year-old also later. Yeah.
13.
Yeah. He like you said, from all ages. And one even had a small child in her bed. Well, he tied them both up and raped the mother while the child is there next to her. That's horrible. That traumatized a small child too.
I don't get how, like, and it's crazy to try to put yourself in that mindset, but I don't get what's pleasurable. Like at the end of the day, sex is supposed to be something to share between a man and a woman that's pleasurable for both. When it's not that way, I don't see how that can be an enjoyable for a man like that. I really don't. You got to be really sick off in the head to be able to get.
That's what these rapists. Yeah, they don't. It's not about the connection and the emotion. It's more about the power that I can inflict on you. You can't stop me.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he part of. He had a power trip. He, like you said, he felt, you know, inadequate in other ways, perhaps, right? Mm-hmm. And this is a power trip to make up for it.
Now he knew that girl's parents had been away on a church outing. So imagine that they're away on a church outing and this is going on. They were away for 3 days. And again, that lets you know right there, they're away for 3 days with a 16 and 17 or 15, 16 year old by themselves, different times. Nowadays, I don't think anybody would do that with what we have going on in the world.
Yeah.
So he knew these girls were going to be alone. You know, they found four pieces of string that didn't belong to any of the victims that was there. So again, he's bringing stuff in there that didn't match anything in the home. There were empty beer cans found in the kitchen. Both girls insisted that they did not come from the house. Neither of them reporting smelling beer on his breath. So he would do this, leave them tied up, then go and basically have a celebratory drink. Besides,
what a nut job.
Yeah. Just relax as you want to be. Like he's not even got a care in the world.
Yeah.
It's crazy. The footprint impressions. So another way how they started getting on the original Night Stalker, they were trying to see if they could get footprint impressions. It indicated that a man was wearing a type of hiking boot and scuff marks on the inside of the back fence indicated that he had left over the fence. So, I mean, just two rapes in and you're already getting similar MOs, modus operandi. You know, you're starting to develop a pattern. August 29th, 1976, a 12-year-old daughter was awake by the homeowner. She was awakened by a breeze stirring the wind chimes outside of her window. Now put yourself, and this is a 12-year-old girl, wind chimes outside the window near the head of her bed. When looking up towards the chime, she saw the head and shoulders of a ski mask figure at her open window.
That's freaking out.
Holy
different
shit.
Different time. People slept with the windows open. Now you want to hopefully lock it all down.
The man started to pry off the screen. And upon noticing the man, she stared at him straight in the eyes and he didn't even immediately move. Instead, just kind of slowly lowered out of sight, which is even more fucking terrifying. I think he doesn't take off and run. He just kind of
shrinks away,
moves out of the way. She ran into the master bedroom where her mother was sleeping. Her father had already left for work. Apparently he worked night shift. Not home. She woke up her mother, told her there was a man with a ski mask at her window trying to get her mother, you know, awake. They run into the bedroom, looked outside, couldn't see anyone at first. Her mother wondered whether or not she had had a bad dream.
Sure.
You know, that something the 12-year-old insisted that a man with a mask was trying to pry off the screen.
Right.
Mother went to the living room, looked around the back sliding glass door, again, seen nothing. Mother decided to wake up the other daughter, who was 15, in her own bed. And the daughter initially was uninterested, was like, what are you telling me for? Call the police. So she's having none of this here. The 12-year-old went back into the girl's bedroom, or her bedroom.
Her bedroom.
Upon entering, they saw the masked man at the window again. After seeing the masked man, they turned around and ran back to the fence in the living room. And her mother ran to call the police. But in their panic, they forgot to close the window while waiting. So I'm guessing he may have not been right at it. Maybe outside of it. Uh-huh. While waiting for the police to pick up, both of them heard the chimes. He crawled through the window. They could hear the drapes and stuff getting pulled.
Oh, man, what a horrible feeling, huh?
So they know he's in the house. I mean, your heart's got to be in your throat at this point. He stood behind them and commanded them both through clenched teeth again, freeze or I'll kill you. Hang up the phone. Now, the balls on this guy to get seen, go away.
Come back.
No, they know, and come back. And they're on the phone with the police.
Yeah, and he knew, because he was watching them, that the husband had left already.
Yeah. So the woman hangs up. Obviously, she's scared. She don't know what to do. She hangs up. The masked man came closer, and she fought. She began to hit her, hit in the head. They was on the floor, the kitchen floor. They were fighting all around this house. She was still conscious. He ordered them to get into the living room. When ordered them to sit on the couch, obviously the mom's begging to leave them alone. As he pulled out and cut a towel from the back of his belt, saying, quote, I only want your money. He grabbed the woman's arm and pulled them behind her to bind her. The woman didn't believe he was there for the money because he was already, again, naked from the waist down.
Yeah.
He just comes in with no pants. Like, just, I mean, this is just obviously his.
He's his ready. He's ready.
Yeah. So she keeps fighting back. Good for mom. She broke free, ran for the door. He ran after her, started hitting her in the head again repeatedly. She grabbed the door handle, opened it, and ran outside with her daughter. And I'm not sure how the daughter's like beside her during all this. I'm not really sure the details of this, but it's crazy. They ran across the front lawn to the next door neighbors, and the masked man went across the street, you know, right behind them. Now, the other daughter's still in the house while this is going on. She hears all this at this time and wakes up.
When she calls the police.
Yeah. Well, at that point, I think the neighbor had opened the door. They went across the street, having heard all this. The 15-year-old took off the screen. She went out her window, hopped the fence, and saw her mother and sister running around the lawn to the neighbor's house. The door opened up, and all three made it inside. So they're in there safe. Another neighbor from across the street noticed the four people running out, four including this masked man, and said one of the men run across the street, crouched down behind the neighbor's bushes. The other three women went into a house. As they were screaming for help, the male who ran across the street watched from the other side, stood up, and then casually walked away. Like, that's horror movie type shit.
It is. That's what it's based on. Freaking nut job psycho. Very slow, methodical, very planning. He got lucky in that one. He could have been easily caught that time also.
He struck again on September the 4th, 1976. Then again on October the 5th, 1976, the attack on the victim number 5 actually started with a break-in. This was September the 20th. So, you know, he's going back-to-back days here. 5 called the police reporting a break-in while she was vacuuming. She noticed some mud or dirt on the 3-year-old son's bedroom carpet, the windows that overlooked their backyard. The first thought was to check for valuables in the house. She checked around the house. She noticed nothing was missing but some costume jewelry that was very inexpensive. Now, they caught this is a very creepy one here.
Uh-huh.
Since the jewelry was inexpensive, they had not really been touched. You know, she wasn't really too concerned about it. They gone through already. Upon going into the backyard, the responding officer accompanying her to her son's bedroom window, where the deputy noticed someone had stepped in mud, she seen pry marks again on the screen. So this is starting to set off some alarm bells. There was also a blue sock in the backyard. The victim recognized the sock to belong to her husband. Now, originally it was written off here that start with, you know, somebody's been in your house because the sock is on the outside. So you're something's off. You can't really place what's off. And you, at this point, you're starting to realize someone's been in your house. Now, it was written off, like I said, as maybe they were just using that as a way not to use fingerprints. That's, you know, which makes sense. Mm-hmm. Put something on there to cover up your fingerprints.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was just saying, like, since nothing of value was taken, there had been no vandalizing. That seemed to the woman that it was a reasonable explanation, because at this time, they're not really letting people know that they have a serial rapist out and about. So there's not a, I guess, a wherewithal to think that this could be, you know, something related. She stated that she had been getting hang up phone calls for about 2 weeks. There was someone on the other end. They wouldn't speak. Then they did. Then they would just, or they never would speak. That she would just hang up. These calls continued, and she began to get a little bit nervous because her husband, the guy, like I said, was a captain in the Air Force. And the victim herself was also reserves stationed at the Travis Air Force Base in Fairfield.
And, you know, and back then, just stop for a second. Back then, it was very easy for him to look into the white pages because most everybody's listed. He knows the address and names. And then you start stalking his victims and tormenting them like that. Very different today, but a lot easier back then.
The early morning on October the 3rd, 1976, she received the last of the hang up phone calls where she got angry. At this point, she's starting to get pissed with all these calls. Told him to stop, you know, stop calling. And with a strong emotion in that whispered through clenched teeth voice, he said, "I'm going to kill your husband." Mm. Mm. Now, whether he was going to say anything else is unknown because she hung up. And, you know, immediately checked all the windows, doors, make sure they were locked. Husband was not available at the base. So when she called, she told him what happened, sent out a deputy. But again, they're blaming this on possible kids in the area. They're not putting this as
still together. Yeah.
Yeah. They're still not putting it together. She went next door to the neighbors that night and actually stayed there till their husband got home. Husband returned Monday, October the 4th in the early morning hours. So, you know, he's, I don't know what his stance on this is. I don't know if he's worried. I don't know where he's at, but on Tuesday, October the 5th, her husband got up as usual, prepared to go to work to the Travis Air Force Base. He leaves around 6:30 AM. At this time, victim number 5 was still in bed with her 3-year-old son. That's 3-year-old son had came and got in the bed. He crawled in just minutes before she heard the husband close the front door. After this, she heard a series of clicks and footsteps running down the hall. In her bedroom doorway was a masked man who only had holes in the eyes. He had a knife raised over his head. Both she and her child were tied up by the man. Tied up by the hands. Imagine that, tying your 3-year-old child up. Like, how?
I think this is the one that was on the documentary that I told you about, 60 Minutes.
Yeah.
And yep. I saw her story is very powerful also.
Yeah. I mean, just, I can't imagine having to sit there and watch your 3-year-old be tied up, hands then, behind their back.
Yeah.
Use sheets for their legs, bound them legs and arms. The boy was sat on the floor. Again, the man kept saying he only wanted money. He mentions money every trip. The knife to her throat and pushed it in slightly, although he didn't draw blood, and warned that if she did not do what he wanted, she would kill both. He would kill both her and the child.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what this woman's going through. She heard him tearing the clothes and the sheets in another room. He walked around the house, came back into the bedroom, checking on her. And before a final return, she heard him move a chair by the front door. Finally, he returned and said he had the money and was going to leave. She relaxed a bit, but then her towels being torn near the bed where the man was at, he comes in and he puts his tool, if you will, in her bound hands and told her to, quote, play with it. Mm. Now she tells him that she can't do this because her hands are tied too tight, which he responds, shut up. So he untied her feet and then raped her. After he finished, he told her he was going to the kitchen to make something to eat. She heard frying pans being used. After a while, the house was silent. She got up, made out the back, called the neighbor's child for help. And that's even more bold. You're just going to cook yourself some food. And this is different. This is in the morning.
In the morning time. Yeah, no, he gets brazen. No doubt about it.
I mean, yeah. I don't know about you, Ignatius, but I can't imagine having to sit there and watch your 3-year-old be tied up and then he's going to, you know, rape you after that. I mean, this is just awful.
I remember watching the interview and she was saying that she had no idea if what he wanted. And then once she untied the backside, then she realized what's going to happen. It's going to, you have to deal with it.
And did you see where it said, I think the 3-year-old boy thought that it was a doctor that was given, like, you know, working on his mom. That's, and I hope, you know, I'm sure now he's obviously learned, but maybe for a long time, that's what he thought.
Cause that's what he hoped so, because that's traumatic otherwise. Yeah.
Now, bloodhound was used in this case. They found a trace of the man followed back behind some areas where some houses were being built. This was being developed. A lot of people had reported seeing like a Chevy Vega. One guy said he had seen it there at 6 a.m. a few days prior. One guy said he made eye contact with the guy. The guy just kind of really eerily stared back at him. The scent ended where it had been reported that this car had been parked. So did you see anything about him driving a Vega or anything like that?
I don't remember the Vega, but I know that he liked to park a distance away. Mm-hmm. That way he can come back and it would be caught in the circle of the investigation. It's a little bit of a waste to get out, a little risky, but he felt it was worth the risk doing that way. And that way, when the police are responding to the scene, he's out of their realm that he's coming to. So interesting.
Number 6 was attacked October the 9th, 1976. She was 18. Also October the 18th, 1976, victim number 9. So, I mean, he's racking them up here.
He's going quick. Yeah.
Day after day, October the 9th, October the 18th, November the 10th, 1976. So he's picking up steam here, and like 7 or 8 were on the same day. How do you do 7 or 8 rapes on the same day?
Well, and that's without Viagra.
Yeah. That's before back in the Viagra. Day.
Yeah.
You wonder, like, I mean, I don't know what, apparently he ain't got a whole lot to work with there. I mean, 7-8 times, that's a tall order. I wasn't doing that in my prime, for God's sakes.
Yeah, no, that's, and plus you have the stress of possibly being caught, right? There's a lot going on there. You don't know what's going on there. And then you got to focus and all that. So, you know, the guy's a sick dude.
Now, between rape 8 and 9, the media ban was lifted in Sacramento. I think they had a paper called The Bee, and it published a story that there was a serial rapist in the community. He quickly became known as the East Area Rapist. So let me throw this out there. Media ban, like I said, was lifted 2 days after Election Day. Now, this is key. The mayor didn't want this to come out before the election.
Hmm.
He wanted to let it pass. He wanted to get reelected because it didn't want to be seen that he didn't have a hold on the situation.
Yeah, weak on crime. Yeah.
The rapist would commit his final rape for 1976, 3 weeks prior to the date of the attack of the number 10 victim. She was age 15, was receiving hang up phone calls at 6:15 on the night of her attack. Her parents left for a Christmas party. She had a cold and decided to stay home. She was playing the piano when she heard a sharp cracking coming from the yard and caught her attention. No further sounds were heard, so she continued to play the piano. Moments later, she heard something, turned around, looked over her left shoulder, and there was a man standing there with a knife to her throat. Holy shit. You're playing the piano
and turn
around. And now there's a guy standing there with a mask and a knife to your throat.
Mm.
I can't even imagine. I mean, this, and in that, you know, the language of the East Area Rapist followed, grinned teeth, that growl, you know, told her if she moved, he would kill her.
And this is before the election, right? This is before or after the election?
I think this is like a week before, 2 weeks before.
And the mayor did not want this out because it might hurt his chances of getting reelected. What a piece. Yeah.
Yep. Didn't want it to seem he didn't like have a hold on the situation.
Mm.
He asked her when her parents would be back so he'll know how much time she had. She didn't know. So he ordered her to get up. He put the knife to her neck. Typical line, quote, get moving. If you say anything, you flinch. I'll push this knife all the way in you and I'll be going into the dark. Pushed her to the garage in the backyard. She saw him remove a cord. And this was a real odd one. He tied her hands up, goes back into the house, and he's doing stuff in the house. He says, if you try to look at my face, I'll kill you. So he's tied this 15-year-old girl up outside, actually on a picnic table. He tied her ankles and tied her feet to one of the, like a patio overhang post. He goes back in the house. He's doing God knows what. He does have her blindfold around the head. says, "I'll be watching every 10 seconds from the window." Now, she heard the man going through the house again, opening drawers, doing whatever, until he said, "Come back," again through clenched teeth. He said, "You ever fuck a guy?" She said no. Then he stood her up, removed her pants, cut her bra with the knife that he had took back from her parents' bedroom, took her to the bedroom, and then raped her, brought her out to the family room, turned on the gas fireplace, raped her again, then another time after that in the master bedroom. So three times he's raped this girl.
That's horrible.
Horrible stuff. And this is one of the worst ones. Like, you know, he's done it multiple times with other people, but just the way he was just taking her outside, bringing her back in, a lot more interaction with her, which I think, you know, we're discussing, which that makes it worse when you actually have to sit there and talk and discuss things. And he, again, in this one would make her say that she liked it as he was doing it. So, he's getting a little bit more sick.
Sadistic. Yeah. Going sadistic. On. One second she's playing the piano all happy. Next thing she's living this house of horror.
Yep. They found evidence that he had come through like a fence area. So again, he's stalking the stuff out. The house that was beside where they lived at, I think, had proven to have been tied to a break-in prior. So he may break into a house, ransack it, do whatever, but then not even maybe come back to it. Maybe go somewhere, you know, across the street. So there's really no rhyme or reason to who and what he picks. It's really crazy here. But what do you think he's thinking here at this point?
After he raped her?
Yeah, like, I mean, what's his mindset? Is there no, I guess, pattern of victims, or is it just...
It's hard to tell, man. But my research, when I look at it, it just seems like different ages, right? I guess he stalks them, and if he likes them, he's attracted to them. Maybe easy opportunity in there. He saw that the family left. She's there alone. He takes advantage of it. And that's sad, because it's an absolute, you know, violation of public trust, especially him being in, you know, law enforcement.
Now, one of the things that they had thought up until this point, that maybe he was going after girls with longer hair. This girl actually had shorter hair, but she had recently had it cut. So that was just something that they were throwing around. The picnic table contained a spot of blood that did not belong to the victim.
Like Bundy, huh?
Yeah.
Like a certain type. He had a certain type. Yeah. Same time period also.
Now, this is where they get his type of blood, because it didn't belong to the girl. So they're assuming it had to come from him. This was type A blood. You know, the ninth victim, they tested against her. Obviously, it wasn't hers. So they know they have his blood type. This is kind of the first time they know they have the East Area Ravens blood type. Yeah. I don't even, do you know your blood type? I don't know my blood type.
I do.
What's yours?
AB positive.
Which is like the most rare? One of them is very rare.
Yours rare one? Okay.
No, no, not mine. I don't know. One of them is. I can't remember. I don't know what mine is. His is A. That definitely, I don't know about everybody else, but for him, it's just stand for asshole. You know, he didn't cut the phone lines again, but this girl was not even able to get to dial anybody anyway. It's just, I don't know, man. The things that he's doing is just so fucking horrific. Like, it's just really sick to think about.
And he's going to escalate, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. He would probably case, like I said, these things multiple nights. And you can imagine how creepy this is, knowing that this guy's been sitting outside your window looking at you for days on end. It's terrifying. Yeah. The girl's parents, like I said, obviously devastated. They come back from this Christmas party. They see everything's going on with their daughter. As a parent, I don't even understand how you get past this. As a child, I don't understand how you get past it. As a parent, it's got to be some...
You feel
really hard stuff.
Guilt, a lot of guilt there for sure. There's a lot of guilt there for sure. And you're right. She needs a lot of therapy to get over something like that. A lot of therapy, a lot of help and everything else. It goes back to a lesson learned, but different times people didn't read. And again, it wasn't out on the media like it should have been, but you know, you try to protect your house, have it well lit, keep it fortified, make it impossible for some sick dude to get in there like that. But when the windows are open and the face comes up and you're sleeping, next thing you open your eyes, you got a guy with a mask looking over your face. Holy smokes.
Mm-hmm. Excuse my notes here. Like I said, this guy is really brazen. No sense of urgency when he's doing this. Sheriff's detectives you know, discovered again that, you know, he had ransacked the house, stolen again, little minuscule things, like, again, not really nothing that you can say, hey, we know it's him because we found this, you know what I'm saying? It's nothing of like high dollar value. Do you think it was one of those cases to where these serial killers would take like little trinkets, little souvenirs, little ornaments?
Yeah.
That was his mode of thinking here.
Yeah. Ramirez used to do that. He used to like take trinkets, right? When he went in there. But remember the one that kind of comparing these two, because they're kind of the same timeline how they did it. Maybe he also copied a little bit when he was reading the paper, because he started a little bit later after this guy. And this was well documented in the same area in the state, right? And maybe he copies an idea. Remember the lady almost had him with a shotgun, but it was empty. We pulled the trigger. He goes in a rage, stabs her, and then takes her eyes out and puts it in a jewelry box and keeps it as a trinket. Well, he's a sick dude like this.
Now, the sheriff did discover, as he was saying, when they were walking back to the area where the beggar was, there was some shoe prints where he had pushed over a fence. This was only the second time that he was known to wear a certain type of tennis shoe. The pattern of the sole was like a zigzag. Victim number 10 clothes were found in the neighbor's yard, including a white shoelace that didn't belong to the victim. Investigative proved that he had tied the victim up with her sister's shoelace. So I'm sorry, actually, that was her sister's shoelace. Thus, it sounds like caused the victim that stopped playing where either one of them were in the house. So he brought the shoelace, I guess, maybe from her room or something. So again, he's using whatever is around, you know, very, very resourceful, I guess, if you want to put that on him. And then coming back to the house that you've already maybe went into before, that's a whole different ball game, man. This guy's on another level. He noticed that this was the first to have, like I said, the hair above the shoulders. So again, there's no pattern. That makes it even scarier when there is no pattern.
Yeah, he just makes up as he goes along, but he feels so confident that he can overcome whatever comes his way. That's a scary guy.
Now the man, like I said, he didn't cut the phone line, but he would start to make phone calls here to some of these people. And we're going to get into those in just a minute. There's a couple more cases I wanted to get into, but some of these phone calls, man, and I got one of them that we're going to play.
Okay.
They're just crazy. So he was, like I said, at this point, he had raped about 10 women throughout 1976. The police hadn't a clue who this guy was. Similar description, but he's wearing this mask. The only thing they really have to go off of is he's white, maybe dark hair, and he's not really a lot of man down there. That's the only thing that they really have to go off of here.
Right. Maybe a shoe print, and he's positive blood type.
A positive blood, not a lot of manhood. You know, and just depending on if he's changing up the shoes, they don't really know that either. From January 77 to May of 77, he would commit 12 more rapes in the first few months. Now, the media coverage here is a lot more prominent as far as the MO is starting to get out. So here's the first event actually with a man here, because the media coverage is even saying that he's avoiding houses with men.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Victim number 16 and a mother too. She was lying in bed with her boyfriend. They were woken by a flashlight, or she was anyway, the woman. She seen a man in a white mask staring at her. Through clenched teeth, he said, "Don't make a sound, I have a gun." The girl woke her boyfriend up, who was laying beside her. He made them both roll over and lay down. He told them all he wanted was money and he would leave. He told them, "Don't move or I'll kill you." Like I did the couple in Bakersfield. So I guess Bakersfield was a location of where some of these previous murders had went on. The man retrieved his wallet from his pants. He made the girl tie up the boyfriend. He again threatened to kill them both if they looked up. The man took the girlfriend to the living room where he tied her up, placed a cup saucer on her back and told her not to move. He done the same thing with the male. Now, as you talked about earlier, he would put this on their back. So if they just tried to move, he's going to be able to tell. He's going to be, you know what they're doing. After he came back in the room where the woman was, removed his pants. So I guess he had his pants on this time, raped the woman. After he was done, he went to the kitchen and ate food like very loudly, like almost as if showing off, like he's doing this. Then he's going to go in here and eat your chicken or whatever the hell he's got in the refrigerator. Oh. After a while, he raped her a second time. He pulled her to the chair that was sitting by a door, raped her a third time. He then left. Now, he would periodically go check on that boyfriend and make sure he hadn't moved and hadn't up. And they obviously called the police after they found you know, after it was, he was gone, because there was a period of time where they just never heard anything. So then they were getting up and, you know, moving around. They found out that he had left some chewing gum there. Now, I know DNA is not prevalent this time. Yeah, I don't know if I would do that. Like, you know, it just sounds like something you don't want to leave. I don't know what the process was at that time. He had also used some silverware.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Saliva.
So he's saliva, prints. I mean, just all kind of stuff that would come off, that would come in handy later on. Not no time soon, but it would come in handy.
Yeah.
Deputies realized that the surrounding areas had experienced break-ins. One guy described that a man even gave chase to the intruder, but lost him. So again, he's testing waters. He's, you know, barely escaping here. His pace really cranked up. He had already killed, you know, but they didn't put two and two together at that point. That was one of the first kills that we had talked about when he shot that guy in the garage. He told some of the rapists that if the rape had bad coverage, that he would kill his next victim. How do you have bad coverage of a rape?
It's only bad coverage.
That's what I'm saying. The rape in itself is bad coverage. I guess, man, if it's not covered heavily is the only thing I can think of.
I don't know. Who knows? When you're a sick guy like that. Mm.
But, you know, Ignacio, one thing is a lot of times, especially women, they're reluctant to report things like this, like rape. They would keep it quiet. That's why a lot of these people, these predators, you know, and obviously there's different reasons, but Weinstein, Cosby, you know, when they do these things, women would much more rather keep it quiet because it's embarrassing. And a lot of times they don't want to report it.
Maybe the number was higher than 50 something.
Could have been. That's just what was, you know, reported.
Yeah.
Now, in doing this, a profile labeled him as a paranoid schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. It's all over the news. Guns are selling off the shelf. They had doubled in sale prices or in sales around the area. They were running out of stock. He's got the whole area shook. Folks were buying big ass dogs. Like the kennels had nothing but like the little small dogs that you could get. People were even going so far, and they interviewed a lady. She would sleep during the day to be able to stay awake at night to make sure he didn't break in her house. He's got this whole town scared shitless.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a good town. You know, you're looking at 70s Sacramento. It's a hardworking and middle class families, and he's got them scared shitless. You're right.
Yeah, I mean it's. Now, the neighborhood actually starts to band together. They get upwards of 300 people that want to kind of try to go hunt this down. So now you got a little bit of vigilantism here, which can also lead to some issues. So with all this going on, they're scared that someone innocent could get shot. You know, when you're on the look for somebody, you might find somebody, even if it's not who you're looking for. You know what I'm saying? So they had to be real careful. Now, the B paper that had ran that article, at this time, the reward, I think, was around 15 grand. There was a dentist, and I don't have his name here, but he actually doubled that and made it 30 grand to inspire more people to catch this guy, which in a way might've made it worse because now you got more people out there trying to hunt somebody for 30 grand. That ain't nothing to sneeze at back in those days.
No, that's a lot of money back then.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. You can buy a nice house for 30,000.
Even sheriffs were like setting up sting operations and houses, trying to bait him. Now, because all this is going on, he's not a dumb guy. He's paying attention to the media. This is when he moved to Stockton, California, and things start to really pick up with the murders. All through 77, he's doing his thing, but he also starts making disturbing phone calls. And here's some of the things I wanted to get into here.
Yeah.
I'm the East Side Rapist. On March 18, 1977, the Sacramento County Sheriff's Office received three calls from a man claiming to be the East Area Rapist. None were recorded. The first two calls received at 4:15 and 4:30 were identical, ended with the caller laughing and hanging up. The final call came at 5 p.m. and the caller said,
"Police Department, Sheriff speaking. You're having to catch me, East Area Rapist, you dumb fuck. Sorry, I'm going to fucking kill you tonight. Be careful."
As with the previous call, the next victim was attacked that night. So he's giving them hints that he's doing this. This is backtracking a little bit. I'm going through all the calls that they recorded that he had. December the 9th, during the 77 Christmas season, a previous victim received a phone call that she attributed to her attacker. The caller said, "Merry Christmas. It's me again."
Oh, man.
Can you imagine?
Horrible. No, that's horrible.
Oh, Jesus.
That would destroy your Christmas, wouldn't it?
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
December the 10th, 1977, shortly before 10 p.m.
It's a horror movie. It's like a horror flick.
It is exactly what it is. He's psychologically fucking these people up.
Yeah.
December the 10th, 1997, Sacramento authorities received two identical calls saying, "I'm going to hit tonight." What avenue? Not what, excuse me, not what, Watt, W-A-T-T Avenue.
Oh, okay.
Both were recorded, and the caller was identified as the same person who placed the call on December the 2nd. Law enforcement patrols increased in that area up until 2:30 a.m. A masked man eluded officers by being seen on a bicycle. He rode a bicycle quite a bit on the White Avenue Bridge. When spotted again at 4:30 a.m., he discarded the bicycle and fled on foot. The bicycle had been stolen. January the 2nd, 1978, the first known victim. This right here is just bone chilling, man. The first known rape victim received a wrong number call asking for Ray.
Hello? Yes, Ray there?
Honey?
Is Ray there?
I'm sorry, Mr. Rock. I'm wrong. Hello?
Another one on January 6, 1978, a man claiming to be the East Area Rapist called the Contact Counseling Service and said, "I have a problem. I need help because I don't want to do this anymore." After a short conversation, the caller said, "I believe you are tracing this call," and hung up.
Yeah.
In 1982, a previous victim received a call at her workplace at a Denny's restaurant, during which the rapist threatened to rape her again. According to the Contra Costa County investigator, Paul Holes, the rapist must have patronized the restaurant and recognized his victim there. So imagine this, like you are going out to, you're like every other guy, you're going out to eat. And then you see one of the women that you've committed this horrible, you know, crime to work and trying to make a living. So then he calls the restaurant to further, it's not enough that you're already done it.
Torment and rub it in. And I know where you work now.
Yeah. Wow. Now I know where you work. So it could happen again. Worse.
Yes.
I mean, I would be scared to death to go back to work.
It'd be like going to have to find a new job. No, for sure.
In 1991, a previous victim received a phone call from the perpetrator that she spoke with him for 1 minute. She could hear a woman and children in the background, leading to speculation that he had a family. Now, the last recorded call come all the way in 2001. And we're skipping way ahead here. 2091. I'm sure there was some in the middle that maybe weren't taken serious. But the last call recorded on April 6, 2001, 1 day after an article in the Sacramento Bee linked the original Night Stalker case to the East Area Rapist, a victim of the rapist received a phone call and asked, "Remember when we played?" Holy shit.
Yeah. No, you don't want to, but I guess you're not going to forget.
Now, in 77, there was a poem that was found. Someone claiming to be the East Area Rapist sent a poem to the, it's called The Excitement's Crave, sent it to the Sacramento Bee. Now listen to how sick this is. "All those mortals surviving birth upon facing maturity, take inventory of their worth to prevailing society. Choose values becomes a task. Oneself must seek satisfaction. The selected route will unmask character when plans to take action. accepting some work to perform, a fixed pay, but promise for more is a recognized social norm, as is decorum seeking lore. Achieving while others lifting should be the cause of deserving fame. Leisure tempts excitement seeking. What's the right and expected seems to tame. Jesse James has been seen by all, and Son of Sam has an author. Others now feed temptation's call. Sacramento should make an offer. To make a movie of my life that will pay for my planned exile. Just now, I'd like to add the wife of the mafia lord to my file. Your East Area rapist and deserving pest. See you on the press or TV. So he's out there, man.
No, he's definitely out there. He's taking time to do all that, and he's still working. I'm not sure at this time he's still with the police department. When did that poem come out? In what year?
That was 77, so I think he was. So
he's still out there busy, and he's working with the police and all that, or he just got fired. I don't know the time frame when he got fired, but, man, he's a busy guy, and he's married, remember, and he has a family.
Yeah, married with a family, and that will kind of become part of his undoings here.
Yeah.
There was two murders I want to mention. The Maggiore murders, I think it is. He actually killed two people while he was, I guess, scouting a home.
Yes, he did.
Walking their dogs.
Mm-hmm.
He just shot and killed, you know, them right there. Just horrible stuff. 1979, October the 1st, an intruder broke in and tied up Galetta couple.
Yeah.
Alarmed at hearing him say, "I'll kill you," to himself, the man and woman tried to escape. He left the room. The woman screamed, realizing the alarm had been raised. The intruder fled on a bicycle. Again with the bicycle, this guy. A neighbor, which was an FBI agent, responded to the noise, pursued the perpetrator, who abandoned the bicycle and a knife and escaped on foot through a backyard. So, again, knowing the area is probably the only reason he's getting away here.
Yeah, for sure.
The attack was later linked to some other attacks. So now they're starting to put a lot of this stuff together. In 1980... on March 13th, 33-year-old Charlene Smith and 43-year-old Lyman Smith were found murdered in their Ventura home. Charlene had been raped. A log from a wood pile on the side of the house was used to bludgeon the victims to death. Their wrists and ankles were bound by a drapery cord. An unusual Chinese knot, or a diamond knot, as you alluded to earlier, was used. That was when he started having that moniker, the Diamond Knot Killer. Because this is so out of the norm, they don't know if this is someone new. August 19th, 24-year-old Keith Eli Harrington and 27-year-old Patrice Briscoe Harrington were found bludgeoned to death in their home in Coxhill Drive, Dana Point's Nigel Shores, a gated community. That's a mouthful there.
Yeah.
Patricia Harrington had been raped, although there was evidence that the Harrington's wrists and ankles were bound. No murder weapon or ligatures were found at the scene. Harrington had been married for 3 months, and at the time of their death, Patrice was a nurse in Irvine, and Keith was a medical student at UC Irvine. Keith's brother, Bruce, later spent $2 million supporting the California Proposition 69, authorizing DNA collections from all California felons and certain other criminals. So a lot of money there to be putting in back in those days. 1981, February 6th. 28-year-old Manuel Whithun, I hope I'm saying her name right,
raped
and murdered in her Irvine home. Although her body had signs of being tied before she was bludgeoned, no murder weapon again. Just the ligatures were found. Though the victim was married, her husband was away, hospitalized, and she was alone at the time of the attack. The television was found in the backyard, possibly the killer's attempt to make the crime appear to be like a botched robbery. July the 27th, 35-year-old Sherry Domingo, 27-year-old Gregory Sanchez became the original Night Stalker's 10th and 11th victims. Both were attacked in Domingo's residence, several blocks down from the Robert Offerman's condominium. Domingo was living there temporarily. It was owned by a relative and up for sale. The offender entered the house through a small bathroom window. Sanchez had not been tied up. He was shot, wounded in the cheek before he was bludgeoned to death with a garden tool. So getting more and more brutal here. Some believe that Sanchez may have actually realized he was dealing with this guy and tried to come at him. That's why he was killed the way he was. You know, it's just more and more brutal murders. There was another one on May 4th. 18-year-old Janelle Lisa Cruz was found dead after she was raped and bludgeoned in her Irvine home. Her family was on vacation in Mexico at the time of the attack.
Remember that one, yeah.
A pipe wrench was what he used here.
Yeah. He just escalated from burglaries to rapes to brutal rapes to rapes and murders, and then he just went all out. And then he stopped.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying here. He just stops. Now, the investigation, we'll talk a little bit about the investigation, because that's just a lot of brutal stuff there we just covered.
Mm-hmm.
They finally started to connect the original Night Stalker cases to the East Area Rapist. It was in 2001 before they put it together.
Yeah, because people have a hard time because, you know, you have the distance, and then once you start putting the DNA together, DNA becomes a big, big problem. Okay, all the DNA matches. That's important.
Yeah, and that's around the time when it started becoming
more
a really huge deal, really prevalent in solving, you know, a lot of these cases. And back in those days, which is how Bundy was able to operate for so long, police departments didn't really communicate with each other all that well. And if they did, it would take weeks to do that. It's not like, you know, you got email now. You can just send something to someone clear across the country and get a response back.
Real quick. Yeah, for sure.
One of the already linked original Night Stalker double murders occurred in Ventura, which was 40 miles south of Goleta, and the remaining murders were committed in Orange County, an additional 90 miles southwest. 2001, several rapes in the Contra Costa County believed that had been committed by the East Area Rapists were linked to DNA from the Smith and Harrington and Whittlam and Cruz murders that we just mentioned. A decade later, DNA evidence indicated that Domingo Sanchez murders were also committed by the East Area Rapist, who was now going by the Golden State Killer.
Mm-hmm. His moniker changed for sure.
Moniker changed. On June 15th, 2016, FBI released further information related to the crimes, including a new composite sketch, crime details, and a $50,000 reward. It's not a lot higher from back in those days to 2016.
No, inflation will eat that one up. So that's the motivation on that one.
Not a lot. The initiative included a national database to support law enforcement investigation of the crime and to handle tips and information. Eventually, though, this is where it all kind of comes down. The use of genetic genealogy searching on GED match. Investigators identified a distant relative of D'Angelo, including members directly related to his great, 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 great grandfather. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 greats dating back into the 1800s.
That's some crazy. They had to use an undercover account to do it.
Yes, because they weren't supposed to give out this information. That kind of became a big deal in how they
did become
a
big deal. That did become a big deal.
Almost bit him in the ass on this.
But he's such a bad guy, and they caught him. I think people realized, hey.
Yeah, if there was a time to turn the cheek or turn the eye, that was it.
Yeah.
The tree eventually linked D'Angelo alone. It contained approximately like 1,000 people over the course of a few months.
They weeded down.
Yeah, you weeded it down, and the place of residence, age, sex, populating all this, it was run. Basically, he was the only one left. Once they kind of zeroed in on him,
right there,
17, this was again, Paul Holes and the FBI lawyer, Stephen Kramer, uploaded a killer's DNA profile from a Ventura County rape kit to the personal genomics of the website GED Match. The website identified 10 to 20 people who had the same great, 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 great grandparents as the Golden State Killer. A team of 5 investigators working with a genealogy, Barbara Ray Venter, used the list to construct a large family tree. From this tree, they established 2 suspects, and one was ruled out, leaving just D'Angelo.
That's right.
On April 18, 2018, a DNA sample was collected from a door handle of a car, and then from a tissue.
I think he abandoned some tissue or something that he had used.
Put a tissue in the trash, and they got that. Once they got that, man, that was it. They had him. They were a match, and since D'Angelo's arrest, you know, like I said, some suspicions have been raised about how I come across that. Glad no lawyer jumped on that to help free this.
Because you don't want that guy out after what he did after all these years. The question becomes, and I think, you know, I remember watching the video. I think I seen the documentary there from 60 Minutes there. They had a hard time believing this was a guy, he was frail in a wheelchair. You know, yeah. Thinking, what? This was this guy, but he, you know, some people don't age well, and he didn't age well. That's for sure.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering after all this stuff, was it mentally stressful to him? Or like, you got to think like the average person, if they do something wrong, especially to something of that magnitude, they're going to be stressed. Like, are the cops going to find me? Am I going to get in trouble? He's raping over 50 women, killing over 13. Like, do you think stress is even a factor in this guy's life?
No, I don't think so. I think he enjoyed it. I think he's a psychopath. He doesn't feel anything for people, right? He's a sociopath, psychopath. They don't feel anything for people at all. But what I looked at his face, and he looked so much older than 72 when I saw him. He looked like he was young as 80. He could barely talk. He whispered, remember, in front of the judge and everything. He couldn't even say his name.
His arrest on the evening of April 24, 2018, Sacramento County Sheriff's deputies arrested D'Angelo in the side yard of a Sacramento home.
Yeah.
Charged with 8 counts of first degree murder with special circumstances.
Unassuming home too. It looked like a middle-class home. You would never guess.
A lot of what he would like break him. Into.
Yeah. A monster like that would be living right next to it. Imagine that, living next to a serial killer like that. Unreal.
On May 10th, the Santa Barbara County District Attorney's Office charged D'Angelo with 4 additional counts of first degree murder. D'Angelo made a confession of sorts after his arrest that cryptically referred to an inner personality named Jerry.
That's right.
Forced him to commit a wave of these crimes that ended abruptly in 86. According to the Sacramento County prosecutor, Thien Ho, D'Angelo said the following to himself while alone in a police interrogation room after his arrest in April of 2018. I didn't have the strength to push him out. He made me. He went with me. It was like he was like in my head. I mean, he's a part of me. I didn't want to do those things. I pushed Jerry out and had a happy life. I did all those things. I destroyed their life. So now I've got to pay the price. Detectives ignored that initial request to speak to an attorney, later citing that the legal theory, the potential Miranda violation, would be justified, with the understanding that the prosecutors could not use the interview against the defendant in court. So even though he's kind of saying this, they couldn't really use it, but I don't know if he's trying to play the insanity card or what he's really trying to do.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah. I would say so, that he's trying to say it wasn't me. It's Jerry. Well, I don't think that's not normal. I don't think anybody says that unless you're a little out there. Very, very similar to almost, you know, what OJ said during that interview. If I did it, right? Yeah. OJ couldn't do it, but this other guy inside me did it. The OJ, you know, wouldn't do this, but you know, it's like this guy here. I'm a good police officer. That guy can't do it, but Jerry could.
D'Angelo could not be charged with any of the rapes or burglaries because the statute of limitations had expired for those offenses, but he was able to be charged, thank God, with the 13 counts of murder and kidnapping. D'Angelo was arraigned in the Sacramento of August 23rd, 2018. November 2018, prosecutors from 6 involved counties collectively estimated that the case could cost taxpayers $20 million. And possibly last upwards of 10 years. At April in 2019 court proceedings, prosecutors announced that they would seek the death penalty. And the judge ruled that the cameras could be allowed inside the courtroom during the trial. March 1st, 2020, D'Angelo offered to plead guilty if the death penalty was taken off the table, which was not accepted at that time.
Yeah.
June 29th, as a part of a plea bargain to avoid the death penalty, D'Angelo pleaded to 13 counts of first degree murder, special circumstances, including murders that he committed during the burglaries and rapes, as well as 13 counts of kidnapping. On August 21st, 2020, D'Angelo received multiple consecutive life sentences without the possibility of parole. D'Angelo offered a brief apology after listening to days of pre-sentencing victim impact statements. That's where the victims of his family get to stand up and have their say to him in court. I've listened to all of your statements, each one of them. I'm truly sorry to everyone I've hurt. In November 2020, D'Angelo was transferred to the North Kern State Prison. As of February 2021, D'Angelo was incarcerated and in protective custody in the California State Prison in Cork.
Yeah, with his health and the way he talks, I don't see him lasting another maybe 5 years, 7 years. So I think that was a good move by the prosecutor's office. Why spend the $20 million? He's going to plead. He's done. He's pretty much end of his life right there. You get everything you want out of it, and you save the taxpayers all that money also.
Did you see anything? Was his family talking? Were they in the media? Because this was a shock to them as well.
Yeah.
Anything about his family and their reactions to all this?
I know that the wife, because I guess on paper, he was still married.
Yeah.
And because they're married, she couldn't really talk about what he said. But I know she must have known something, most likely. I mean, it's just, what can you say about that?
Well, the thing that I did hear in a report, and I don't know if I mentioned this in the notes, but he would want to have sex with her, but forcible sex, like not enjoyable sex. And she made it known to him that this wasn't something that she liked to do. And not only would he like to do it, like he wouldn't, trying to do this candidly, he wouldn't want to finish. He would want to do it, stop, go to another room, come back, start again. That was his way of prolonging this, I guess, much like he would do with some of these victims. You know, do whatever he was going to do, go make him a sandwich or drink a beer or cook chicken, whatever the hell he's doing.
Again,
and all these people's refrigerators, and then come back. So I guess the oddball mannerisms were there, whether or not she knew, you know, I guess that's
what did you think he was doing in these late hours?
That's something I never got. I never found anything with her.
I mean, you're married to this guy. He's disappearing all hours of the night. You know, where the shift he's working and he's coming back and she knows she can tell, you know, married couple that he's having sex, right? She can tell. So,
but a sex drive on this fucking guy had to be insane because he's wanting to do this and come home and have sex with his wife. I don't even know how he's getting off at home. I mean, Jesus Christ.
No, that's something else. His adrenaline is really in a different gear there. So he's an addict. I think he's a sex addict. That's what it is.
Yeah, I think that's partially that's got to be something of what he is. And then that just ballooned to where it's like anything else. You start off on one drug. You do it long enough, eventually that drug isn't enough. So you have to step it up.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying he became addicted to murder, but you know, at some point, obviously the sex wasn't enough. Then he graduated.
He liked it. I think you're right. And he doesn't care what people's feelings or emotions or anything. He can say, and then he torments them.
And had he not killed these people, Ignacio, if he did get caught for these rapes all these years later, imagine catching him and then not being able to do anything about it. The statute of limitations had been gone by that point.
Yeah, that would be frustrating.
You hate to even comprehend trying to put into words, thankfully he did commit murder, because obviously we didn't want nobody to die, but like had he not, he would have gotten away with all this and there wouldn't have been nothing they could do about it.
Yeah, and the question becomes, why did he stop?
Yes.
What happened there? I can't figure what happened. Did he get finally the help he needed? Did someone come in there? Did she get him the help? Did that happen? Those are interesting questions I have. It's like, that's so odd. A lot of these guys, you know, the Bundys, the Dahmers, they don't stop. This guy didn't stop.
The only one that I've read on and reported that stopped for a lengthy period of time might have been BTK. And I forgot how long of a time period he did stop, but I think it was close to like 10 years.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that neighborhood.
Yeah, you look at other big name, Pedro Lopez, you know, the monster of the Andes. You know, if they get arrested, what have you, they stop for a little bit, but then they go back into it when they can because they're so addicted to it. All these guys are, because like you said, I was hurt and I want to hurt other people. But very strange, when I read that, Ramirez wouldn't have stopped. If he didn't get stopped early, I think he would have kept on going.
Right. And prison, I mean, you're going to stop if you're in prison. That's why, you know, a lot of the looks of the Zodiac around certain people, they say the letters stop when people were in prison. But if you're not in prison and you never got caught, it's hard to stop cold turkey, especially when you're doing some six in one night. That is another level of an addiction.
It is. This is fascinating. I'm glad you didn't know much about him. I'm glad you did the research. I'm glad you saw, because when I put in my book, it's Psycho Killers, and I have this guy, we talk about Ramirez, we talk about Gacy, we talk about Faye, I put a host of them, we're talking maybe H.H. Holmes and others down the road, probably America's first serial killer. And maybe even tie into Jack the Ripper. We'll talk about that down the road. But he caught my attention to how he just stopped like that. That's not what these guys do.
Yeah.
So he must. And he said, Jerry, maybe he said, and I guess one of the family members, I forgot who said it in one of the documentaries, saying, and research, is that he was a very kind, nice person, I guess, in the later years. So maybe he did get some help that he needed, and he got away from the Jerry, the bad, evil Jerry that was causing him to do all that. I don't know. I'm just speculation on my part. But those are questions I feel like. Like, what was she thinking when he's gone all hours of night? He's working. He smells. He smells like sex. She can smell it. And then you don't see anything unusual, bumps and bruises and mud covering his shoes and everything.
He's got to have a car, because otherwise he's riding around like waist naked on bicycles out here, for crying out loud. I mean, like, you know, nowadays maybe that might not be strange in certain neighborhoods, but a man wearing a damn, you know, a ski mask, riding around with no pants on a bicycle. I mean, how does this not draw some fucking eyebrows here?
I know Bundy's girlfriend, that was the reason she picked up unusual thing, him having dresses, right? Him having all these other things like a butcher knife and a thing that doesn't make sense, crutches. Remember all the things he was having? He doesn't limp. He doesn't have any issue. Why does he have all this? He must have had the same things. Why does he have all these ski masks? Why does he have all this other stuff? I'm not sure what she did or didn't. Who knows? Maybe we'll never know that part. Wow. That's the things I thought about. Maybe the law enforcement or just going diving into this. How you not know you're living with a predator like this and you don't pick up these signs? Pretty much an unbelievable monster.
Mm-hmm. You would hope at this point, maybe he would try to help shed some light on some of this stuff. If he does have any remorse, like he claimed in his last statement, like, why wouldn't he bring to light of some of the, why did you stop? You know, was it that you felt the heat coming down? What it could have been possibly is you're getting a little older. So, you know, you're not as capable physically to taking on some of these people. Cause I mean, you know, this was a good little run that he had here. So he's getting up in age. Maybe he's, you know, and also you got to look at, he's terrorized this whole fucking town, city, in multiple areas.
Yeah.
People are going to start arming themselves. People are going to start getting guns. People are going to start getting dogs. People are going to start getting security systems. So the more you get away with something, this is true for anything, not just what he was
harder. Doing. Yeah.
More people are getting away with something, people are going to in turn make that harder to get away with.
No, I agree. And that opened up a lot of things there. People are looking at. So those are interesting questions I had about why he stopped. What did she know? When did she know? I mean, what was she an enabler? I mean, was she part of it? I mean, you don't know. I mean, no. And then all of a sudden, was he able to get, you know, his medication or whatever he needed so Jerry go away? Interesting questions.
Yeah, for sure. Well, there you have it, folks. The Golden State Killer.
Yeah.
Hell of an episode. Ignacio, tell everybody where they can get your book. And also, ATF Undercover done quite well this week, I've seen on your social media
profile. Yeah, man. You can see the poster behind me here. I had it for free. I downloaded about close to 300. People really liked it there. And I guess there's a lot of excitement, too. I've been announcing it, too, working on a series. It can be called Broken Crowns, based on ATF Undercover. Shout out to David Steenhook. He is the founder and CEO of QE, of Question Everything Productions, right? We're going to be working on that and hopefully have it out next year and a half or so. If everything goes well, we'll get the investors. And it should be hopefully a good pilot and then a hell of a series. So I'm excited about that, excited about the books. And they're also on Audible. They're doing really well on Audible. The Most Dangerous Crime Syndicates of Our Time has done really good. It's been based on, of course, the mafia, the one percenters, street gangs, prison gangs, cartels, narco groups. So it's pretty cool. If you really want to have an idea of all the different groups, I think it's almost like an encyclopedia sense where you get a good feel for all these different groups in the history. And then my assessment where I see the mafia has fallen, the Italian mafia in this country, but the cartels and street gangs are just flourishing. And that's one of my big assessments there. And you get some good ideas, which groups I see where, which are the stronger ones, and based on my experience. And then, of course, ATM Undercover, all the cases I did. As you know, I think you heard it, you liked it. I put a lot of people away who did a lot of bad things.
Oh, yeah. Definitely go check that out. Well, again, as always, when we have Ignacio on the show, we put links to his Amazon profile there. You can go check out all of his books. Got a number of books. What are you at now? 50 plus, 60 plus? What are you at now?
Yeah, 76.
76. This man gets another 20 books every time he comes on the show. You're coming by once a month now. So
76. I have slowed down because of other projects, But I am looking to add one with this. We're doing all this behind the serial killers, you know, psycho killers, and infamous LA murders. Interesting, which maybe we'll talk about eventually. Some famous LA murders. I think the Black Dahlia, I think, is fascinating. I didn't realize some of the things that happened in that case, which I think will be a fascinating show we can do. The Menendez brothers and the Wonderland murders also. And I mean, there's so many good stuff that we can talk about that I'm putting all together. And then I'm doing one on NFL killers, guys who were in the NFL, left NFL, involved in some heinous, heinous crimes. So that's what I'm going to start working on for the holidays. Just perfect time for the holidays and Christmas.
Yeah, give some good reads there. Good Christmas gifts for people.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to the NFL one also. And one of the ones we had on Crime and Entertainment not too long ago, I actually got to sit down with Chris Colombo, who's the only surviving son of Joe Colombo, who was obviously head of the Colombo, we'll call it family, because Chris doesn't necessarily agree with the crime family aspect of it. But fascinating interview, man. Chris was a fantastic dude. I've spoken to him many times before and since the interview. I've got the utmost respect for him. And to be able to have someone, you know, that grew up with Joe Colombo as a father and seen guys like Carlo Gambino, you know, at a young age, Martin Luther King, he's seen at a young age. I mean, it was a fascinating show, and I encourage everybody to go check that out. He didn't necessarily, you know, go into that. He was a big bookmaker, so that was kind of where he made his money. And bookmaking. And a lot of these guys now are just flabbergasted that it's legal now. You can't watch a football game without 15, you know, DraftKings bet commercials going on. And yet they tried to put those guys in jail for it all those ways. So as we talked about in these shows,
it's like bootlegging. Alcohol became legal. Look at marijuana. I think more states are legalizing now. I've done a few shows. Actually, if you want to check those out. Making the case why I think we're transitioning as a country to seeing it legalized more and more, not just for medical use, but for recreational use. You know, alcohol is legal, and you see, you know, people and comparing the two, where alcohol is a lot worse than marijuana. And I've been on some of these shows, and of course we've had, I think I've been on the show with you or another one, and doing with shout out to Tim McBride also.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Tim's a great guy.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, that'll do it for this episode of Behind the Serial Killer. I'm Hollywood Wade. That was Ignacio Esteban. And unfortunately, we are out of time. Tune in next week on an all new episode of Crime and Entertainment, next month for an all new episode of Behind
the Serial Killer.
Ignacio, we'll see you, my friend.
See you, brother. All right.
Boy, oh boy, what an episode that was. As I said, folks, that's going to round it out here for 2023. I appreciate each and every one of you guys listening. We're still going to keep pumping these things out once a week. I really hope everybody's enjoying it. Please, if you're watching on YouTube, leave comments. Let us know what you think. If you're on audio, please leave any sort of review you would like on there as well. You know, we're on Spotify. We're on Apple, Amazon, Google Podcast, anywhere you get your podcast, folks. Crime and Entertainment is out there. So help drive us up the chart. Share away if you would. That would be an easy way to do it. Free. We don't ask to dip into your pockets. Also on all the social medias, we're on Instagram, Crime, the letter N, and Entertainment. And in there, you can click on the bio. There'll be a link tree in there, and that'll take you to everything we're on. We're on Facebook, TikTok. It had links to all of our audio platforms as well as the YouTube. So share if you will. We put pictures on there as well that goes along with our episodes, plus shorts throughout the week. So maybe you can catch a short and see if you you know, maybe the episode got by you, but if you see the short, it might just look like something you want to go and rewatch. We won't hold you up, ladies and gentlemen. I'll let you get back to it with your families. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Behind the Serial Killer on the Golden State Killer here on Crime and Entertainment.